Hello, and welcome to the Screen Composer Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. Alberta-born Jonathan Kotchuk is interested in where and how we live as a means to give his music context. He completed a Bachelor's of Music at the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts, worked with Nico Muhly, Ben Frost, and the Philip Glass Ensemble, as well as studying wildlife field recording with Chris Watson. The environment, the sounds that arise from it, and how his own music interacts with the environment are themes that permeate his music over the course of several albums. The most recent, Everyone, takes these ideas to the extreme, allowing for only three sound sources: the human voice, sign tones, and the sound of the Kananaskis Rockies. The resulting work, which required pre-market software to realize, was mixed for Dolby Atmos and uses no compression, EQ, or reverb. In his film work, which includes NFB feature Memento Mori and the indie hit Clara, he is equally daring. We chat about the incredible and unintended technical complexity of creating Everyone, his interest in environmentalism, athleticism, exhaustion, and fear in his music, his recent score for Niobe Thompson's documentary Carbon, the unauthorized biography, and the bridge he navigates between being a recording artist and a screen composer. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. It really helps us grow and share the stories of these amazing creators. And now, please enjoy this intriguing look into the work and process of Jonathan Kotchuk. So I guess since we're rolling and there's no introductions, Jonathan, tell us or tell the listeners where we are.
Yeah, we are in Hamilton, Ontario, of all places. We're on the mountain, right?
Yep.
Which I'm learning about. It's my first time in Hamilton, and we're doing it in person.
We're doing it
in person. The first one.
The inaugural in-person guest. This started as a pandemic project, and here we are.
Traveled three time zones to be the inaugural.
Just for me. But actually not. It's because your new album, Everyone, got released on June 10th.
It did, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's very exciting, and it's an absolutely... beguiling and compelling work of significant scope. But, you know, listen, I had to sort of, I didn't want to, tomorrow is the real presentation, a premiere, if you will, right?
It is, yeah.
And you guys are going to be doing it at what theater is it happening at?
It's at the AVX Cinema, the Cineplex at Yonge and Dundas.
And playing in Dolby Atmos.
Playing in Dolby Atmos.
Full, and that's the way the album is supposed to be presented.
I would say so, yeah. We recorded it in Dolby Atmos from the ground up. And it's going to be nice to be in an environment where a bunch of different people can hear it and not just in one studio with one listening position.
Right.
I'm pretty excited.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Well, it's really great. And obviously people can check it out on all the ways you can get music these days.
It's true.
We'll get back to that album, but at first, let's see, where do I want to take this first? Sort of looking at your body of work and looking at where you've come from and sort of like all the materials that sort of tell the story of Jonathan, leave out a sort of large portion in the beginning. And I'm sort of, I'd love for you to fill in the blanks for me of sort of where your journey began, because you have a very interesting and sort of very focused approach to what you do. And you have a sort of concept you seem to be building on through each iteration, through each different album that you're putting out, and all of your work sort of incorporates this in some way. And I'm so curious to know what was your experience growing up and getting into music creation and where that sort of initial spark for that idea came from.
Yeah. Oh man, what a great question. Well, I guess I can speak about both film composition and making records on this show, because which is unique, as we were saying off air. Like I usually have to silo talk about one or the other. So, God, what to say? I mean, I was definitely not Suzuki trained at four. Tell you that much. I learned what quarter notes were like 3 weeks before the entry exam into music school and university. So
where do you start? Is it it's in Alberta, right? Are you?
Yes.
You're Edmonton born?
Calgary born.
Calgary
Edmonton
born.
Raised.
Okay. Yeah.
Truly the gamut of an Alberta cowboy sort of, you know, that's offensive to my cowboy friends. I wouldn't claim it was a joke for whoever's listening. No, I basically, there's a few seminal moments that happened. I didn't make a volleyball team that I thought I would be on. I was a very competitive volleyball player. And then I got short and I had a summer to myself. I thought I would be in Lethbridge playing for Team Alberta, and I wasn't, which I'm not over. And I, at the time, was kind of getting into music. I was supposed to buy a bass guitar for the band that I was in. Some other dude got it before me. It was like this specific guitar that I wanted and was the only one I had money for. So I ended up buying a synthesizer that came with like Cubase 5LE or something. I can't even remember. Like, it's just a version of some DAW. And kind of at the same time, I didn't make that team, and I bought this little field recorder for the summer, and I found myself in the forest behind my house hitting sticks and stones together to make drum samples and learning how to get music into a computer. And kind of also around there, I was like a screamer in like a punk band or something that we never played a single show. But I was interested in harsh vocals and still very much am interested, and I started taking vocal lessons to try to not hurt myself. So that, in a way, it just kind of formed fully at the beginning in a really rudimentary way, my interest in voice and manipulating that on a computer. And then I've always been a big ecology nerd, and I didn't want to pick between that and music. And yeah, it kind of, now that I'm having to talk about this record a little bit in the last few weeks, I'm realizing just how maybe early that started, that kind of stuff.
When you say ecology nerd, I mean, is that sort of a result of being of the proximity to the Rockies? Because that's still a big relationship for you, obviously.
Yeah, I think so. I think even more than that, you know, my dad is a researcher, but he was also a blog hound, and we never listened to like dad rock. Which we could edit out. I'm sure there's dad rock won't age well as a term, so I apologize to future dads. But, you know, both him and my mom were just so into new music. I would cover CBC Radio 3. They would cover NME. And together we'd know what was coming out. And that, so both in a scientific way and in an artistic way, discovery was the currency in my household. So, they were kind of the same, and I thought I was going to go into biology in university or even paleontology quite seriously. Like, I still volunteer at a paleontology lab when I'm back home. And then I just didn't. I think it's maybe the same way that a sports journalist thought they were going to play baseball and then started talking about sports through the written word. Sure, they like the written word, but they're actually sports people. I'm kind of that way with the natural world. Like, I just so love the way that it functions and learning about it. I'm a total dilettante. Like, I don't actually know what I'm talking about, but I love nature, and music is kind of like the medium I have to explore that.
What kind of research is your dad?
Yeah, hard to even say. He does so many things. He is a spine researcher, a lower back pain researcher.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And he has a big robot lab with all cool toys and mocap suits and it's really
so it really is like cross like there's a lot of different sort of like ways of doing this research that incorporate even things like mocap suits, which you normally associate with making video games or special effects for movies.
I think we have the same job in a way.
Yeah.
He's constantly writing grants. He's trying to do the thing he likes and minimize how much he has to teach. And it's the same, but he's also collaborating in sort of very like, multidisciplinary way. Like, he'll think of something, but he'll need to bring on somebody from the Faculty of Computer Science, and an idea will necessitate sort of cross disciplinary collaboration for him. And I think I am basically just doing the same thing as him, but as a musician.
This idea that, you know, what we see and what we experience, especially growing up, is what we believe is possible. So there's kind of an interesting connection there between you between that idea of scientific inquiry and exploration and discovery that sort of carries in through your work, and also the integration of technology and going, okay, I want this. How do I get that by using technology? Or, you know, that's a really interesting connection there. So you sort of come to music a little late, in a sense, and then you end up in Liverpool, right? For the Institute of Performing Arts.
Yeah. I had quite a round the world, path. I did 4 years of school, but somehow managed to go to like 5 different institutions and not lose a year.
Wow.
Because of just really trying to game the system. I went to McEwen for a couple of years. I did an internship in Iceland for recording. I went to UBC for a year. I needed to not do that. It wasn't the right fit. I made a mistake going there. Great school, not for me. And then I found a way, a very long and convoluted story of doing my last year in Liverpool, and they were all different genres of school, kind of. There was jazz, and then there was like pure recording at the height of like Icelandic kind of that aesthetic and the rise of Johan Johansson at the time, and then at the conservatory in UBC, and then kind of like a pop school in Liverpool. It was a very weird path.
So what about UBC made it not a good fit?
I think it was frustrating for, I think I would appreciate it more now, but 36 hours after I finished my internship, I was at in UBC.
Okay.
And, I had just seen what composers do in real life and what they need to learn.
Right.
And, or that specific type of composer. And I just got it in my head that I had this huge gap of knowledge when it came to classically orchestrating stuff, and I thought I don't know, one of my people that I was working under in Iceland was Nico Muli, and he's just this amazing, very well trained, Juilliard trained classical musician, and I just thought I had this gap, and I did, and I still do. So I was like, let's fix that and go to UBC. What I actually probably needed to do was nurture the stuff that I enjoyed doing. I also was very much taking the whole like practice the stuff you're not good at approach rather than lean into the stuff you are good at.
Mm-hmm.
And I somehow went to UBC with this just insatiable interest in eco-musicology and soundscape ecology. And no one told me or directed me towards Simon Fraser or even like the faculty at UBC who literally invented soundscape ecology. That's where it started at Simon Fraser with a little bit of a crossover at UBC. Like I was in, it would be like if you were going to university in Brazil, but you're really into soccer and no one told you that, like it was insane. So I'll need to if I ever get to redo my life in some version of the afterlife, I'm going to have to like do a better job in Vancouver, I think. Yeah.
Well, for all intents and purposes, it seems like you did very well. The internships sound fascinating. So that actually happened. Those went on before ending up at Liverpool. Is that right? Mm. And so you went for a recording internship in Iceland. You studied gamelan in Indonesia, wildlife recording with Chris Watson in England.
Oh yeah.
You worked with Nico Muli, Ben Frost, and you did some work with the Philip Glass Ensemble. Like, how does that all fit together? Like, how did those opportunities come your way? And what was it that you were sort of investigating with all that stuff?
That's so funny. When you put it like that, it sounds like I earned those opportunities, and I absolutely did not. Like, it's just like a person would imagine. I met Philip Glass's front of house guy, Dan Bora, great dude, in Iceland when I was like 19. And I knew the Glass Ensemble was playing in London when I was in England. And I just contacted him. I was like, can I wrap cable and be helpful and learn a thing or two, honestly? And he was like, yeah. And then I did. And then they put me to work a little bit for that night. And like it, and the same thing with the Chris Watson thing. Like I just, especially in England, because everybody's a trainer right away, people are so willing to just give you an afternoon because they remember what it's like, and they were often given an afternoon. And you just, I don't know, I would just ask very honestly and just be, hey, like, I don't know, like, I'm young, I'm not trying to steal anyone's job or like weasel my way into anything, but like, these things are nourishing, like, can I buy you a coffee? And then, you know, angels like Darren Fung come down from on high, and like, that's how my relationship with Darren kind of started. Or even just one of the most transformative experiences of my professional life was hanging out with John Luther Adams for an afternoon. And when I tell people that, they're like, oh my God. And I was like, I legit just emailed him and was like, I'm a young composer, please give me an hour of your time, it would mean a lot to me. And of course he did, because the only people working after a certain amount of years are like the nice ones. In a way.
Well, I mean,
we would hope.
Yeah, but. No, absolutely. And I think part of the too is, or the surprising truth is that, you know, good things come to those who ask, in a way, because so few people do actually just ask. We have these, I think, these assumptions that these types of people, John Luther Adams or Philip Glass or whoever, or even middle-level people for that matter, are too busy and you're not worthy of their time for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I always say when I go to conferences or I'm speaking on panels or, you know, giving my time to people sort of in a group, I say, I'm going to give you my email address at the end of this. Please reach out to me. And know, secondly, that 99% of you won't.
Yeah, I've done the same when I've spoken at stuff and nobody does.
Nobody does.
It's incredible how. Yeah. But also by the same effect, like, I have 99.9% of the emails that I send out being like, hey, man, like, can you give me some time, or, you know, like, trying to just get a hold of whoever that just like either don't respond or.
Yeah.
I mean, the Icelandic opportunity came in a way because of getting rejected for that. I was leaving that part of school and I wanted some advice and I wanted to email my favorite composers and see what they would do if they're in my shoes all over again.
Mm.
No one got back to me.
Yeah.
But then I won a raffle for an album from that label. And they didn't know how to ship to Canada. And then they figured out that, hey, we have an email from you already. Why is that? And then it got the ball rolling. So it, yeah, like, I don't know. I go for volume rather than, I email so many people this stuff.
Really. That's great. I mean, yeah, honestly, that's what it takes too, right? I think it's the idea, I suppose, of not attaching too much meaning to a non-response. Which usually is, oh my God, I'd love to answer this, but it's just, I can't right now, or,
yeah,
you know, whatever else. Or maybe, like, you know, if you're saying to someone, what would you do if you had to start over? Then maybe they go, I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
I'd probably not do it, or that's too hard to answer, or whatever else. The currency of attention is something not to be undervalued either. I think that just to sit there and go, I just want to hear what you have to say. Talk to me for an hour. They'll go, oh, cool.
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, just being, listen, a bottle of maple syrup goes so far. Truly, I bring maple syrup every time I talk with somebody in the US or abroad. Yeah. For this, and just, you know, to say, hey, like, you know, I really appreciate the attention that you gave me here, and yeah, people remember that. That's another Darren Fung thing. That dude has really taught me to like, above and beyond, take care of the people,
yeah,
you work with, and like, make sure they're fed, and yeah, people remember that stuff.
It's so funny how, like, it's such an ancient human, if not even proto-human thing, that we appreciate sustenance. And if you bring someone food, you're like, okay, you're good. You know, that's like a big thing.
Totally.
So much so that, you know, that saying, there's no such thing as a free lunch, exists because people will actively reject it because they know that if they say yes, they'll feel this sense of obligation to you.
Yeah.
There's so many weird things about that kind of psychology when you start getting into the relationship thing. I find super fascinating. What would you say, you know, if you can sort of combine like all these moments, working with Ben, Nico, Philip Glass Ensemble, you know, doing the Icelandic thing. Are there sort of like the main things that you take away from that? Like the things that really pushed you forward and you're going, okay, this is the thing that I really made into a bread and butter thing for the remaining time that I've been working.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, kind of what you're saying about advice, I truly believe to some extent no one can give you advice because of like sort of the exponentially growing technological landscape that we live in. A composer who's 5 years my senior, the environment that she grew up in as a composer is gone, you know, and there's certain helpful things that will always be helpful, of course, but there's no model that you can, you're not a blacksmith being like, oh, like, I guess this is how blacksmiths get started. It's you're essentially, like, so as far as tangible stuff like that, I learned basically nothing, to be frank, you know, that would apply to how I was going to like lift myself into a career. But what I really, really learned from these people, I mean, it was two things. Watching them at the dinner table, which was how they conducted themselves. I talked to them once about it. They said they didn't realize they were doing this, but they don't talk about music at the dinner table. They actually take breaks. And just sort of through osmosis, figuring out how they just carried themselves was interesting. Two, and I won't name names, but, you know, there were some, as with all the arts, sometimes people get into art because they have demons that they're trying to, you know, exercise. And there was a lot of like great examples of how I don't want my life to go as a composer, of people that I have worked with. John Luther Adams was a shining example of how I would want my life to go. He's a beautiful man who really gives, just cares about people. And he has a very beautiful like thing going on. So it wasn't him. But, you know, and then just seeing in Iceland in particular, like Ben and Nico and Valgir, they all came to this place where they've met from different traditions. Ben studied visual art, you know, Nico was sort of like a choir boy, you know, all this stuff. And they just did their thing so hard that it really made me wonder, if I just do my thing as hard as these people have done their thing, I don't want to do their thing. I don't want to become like Ben Frost too. And he's so influential. Like, I mean, like a lot of people are Ben Frost too. He's like a very influential dude. And I was for a while too, like ripping off Ben Frost. But, you know, if you just sort of lean into what you find interesting as heavily as these people did, what's that look like? That was really inspiring.
Yeah. That's interesting. Do you consider yourself an artist?
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Oh man. Wow. I haven't actually thought about this. I feel like my view of this is just super functional. Like I make art. I don't think it necessarily relates to the fact that I attempt to, and sometimes succeed at making a living from it. I don't know. I almost am embarrassed to say that so many people are so uncomfortable calling themselves an artist, and imposter syndrome is like its own pandemic. I've never experienced it because like I've been lucky enough to have these experiences with being around, you know, the big, scary, you know, quote, real artists.
Yeah.
Like nobody's on the inside. It was so clear to me just being around these guys. Like they're just trying to figure their stuff out too. And I guess at a formative enough age, I had sort of the man behind the curtain shown to me of like, oh, like there's not like a bloodletting ritual where you wind up an artist after that happens. Like, I don't know. That whole real versus not real thing, which maybe I don't know if you're getting at that, but it just wasn't a problem for me, luckily, early on, because I saw that. I guess the only time I felt that way was with going to UBC after seeing Nico, who could like legit Amadeus style look at a page of music and hear it in his head. I was like, oh man, like I'm not a real composer if I don't know how to do that. It's the only time I felt that way, and that so quickly evaporated when I realized that I don't have the patience to learn how to do that. I don't know.
What is driving what you do? Because I find this very impressive, and I feel like I'm looking at this thing from the outside. My journey, as I've stated before on this podcast, is that I actually went to school for fine art, for visual art rather, and not because I was interested in becoming an artist or in visual art, but because I wanted to become an illustrator, and the program I wanted to go into was full. So in a weird way, I kind of learned about the art world and about that kind of, you know, the way there's a, what I find so interesting now is looking back on this or learning more about it and the kind of this idea of codified languages, you know, like the way that you speak about certain things, there's a certain language that surrounds art and artists that I find is sort of its own very specific universe. And for me, one thing, the main thing I learned was through art school was I'm very interested in problem solving. I'm very interested in process. And I have absolutely no interest in pursuing art as an artist in terms of there's some internal expression that I need to get on and communicate with other people. I'm much more interested in finding other people who have problems and helping them solve those things. That's where I've landed. And I've had to battle that myself. And even people, like, it's sort of funny when I say I'm not an artist, there's some people that really get offended by that. And they want me to call myself an artist. And I'm like, I don't think I am. And I'm actually happy with that. I'm very comfortable with it. That's really cool. But what I'm interested in is this drive. Because, I mean, from the one thing I have to say is that while in reading you, and we sort of had a conversation about, like, artist statements and, like, how people talk about what they do. And this extends to composers talking about their works for film and television as well. There's a difference between the work itself and how people might appreciate that and what your thoughts about it are and how you talk about that. But my impression of you as a person has always been one of the least pretentious, warmest, generous, just easy to talk to people that I've ever met. But you can also pull that language out, but it's always authentic. Like, it's genuine. You're trying to use the most effective words possible to communicate what your ideas were. Is it a drive? Do you feel driven to make work, or do you feel it's just a curiosity that you're following?
Oh my God. First of all, what a relief to know that hopefully I don't come off as pretentious. for me, I think being a composer has always been a bit of a wrapper to actually just do whatever the fuck I want. Anyway, I am driven by learning new stuff. Like, I just like love learning new stuff. I love new experiences. And hilariously enough, I can do that as a composer, and that I don't have to switch jobs every time. I can become really, really, really obsessive about a certain topic that is like truly speaking to me. And I can find a way to sort of, become an alchemist of turning that into my job, to make music about it, to research more about it, to commission album art around it. I've learned so many weird skills through being a composer, specifically about, like, making records, because you're the head of department for every department when you make a record. I've learned like some basic things about CNCing and 3D printing, because that, like, we did a little bit of that to facilitate some of the album art, some GIS stuff, because I was pulling satellite data to make 3D models that were going to be cast in pine resin for the, like, I get to learn so many new things every time I make a new work. That's what I love doing. And and then my other favorite thing in the world, which is music, comes out of it. I'm extremely lucky to be able to do that. I think if there was another job where I could cheat my way into learning stuff all the time that I'm interested in and doing big, big, big deep dives, and somebody told me I couldn't be a composer, like, I would be also happy doing that. But yeah, it is in a way just a convenient sort of whatever that, like, plastic stuff around sausages is, like, that's composition.
Casing,
casing that I can cram whatever I'm into.
Oh my God, that's funny.
This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights of film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. And now, back to our show.
I don't know where I got this from, but it's almost felt like a little bit of a, what would you call it? Not a manifesto, because that's too strong of a word, but you're sort of outlining the things that inform your work. And it sort of will lead into, I think, the talking about the album a little bit. But one of the first things you're talking about, athleticism, exhaustion, replenishment, and imposing comforting nature of the Rockies are even more beautiful when they all interact. This idea of biophonic sound, which I have to ask you what you mean by that. What I like is you say hyper-affecting, unafraid to be emotional.
Yeah.
And then capturing these natural spaces literally and emotionally with music and audio, because they'll likely be gone by album number three. So you're saying, like, it's almost like a photograph of a space in a way, to saying, here's what I felt about it, or here's what it was. 8 years in the making, only three sources of sound to create it, an enormous amount of very complex technology to do it, and putting yourself, in some precarious situations, I'm sure, in the middle of of almost nowhere in the Rockies to make this thing called Everywhere. Where do you want to start with this? It's a huge project.
Oh man, yeah, I don't. Where to start with this?
And by the way, this is so perfect. We've got the rain coming down. If everyone can hear this on the roof here, we've got this nice environmental sound going on.
It was really so nice of you to hire all these Foley artists that are around us. We have
on command
stabbing sounds coming. The idea to record music, to re-record music outdoors was a thing I explored in my first record. And it became clear I needed to, like, do that to sort of its terminal velocity at some point.
Mm-hmm. And when you say re-record music, what do you mean by that? This, if you could define, or like put us in that space, that moment, what does that look like?
Yeah. So for everyone, that looked like bringing 7 speakers out into Kananaskis country and setting them up in a big circle with like a radius of like 18 meters or something, and blasting back a bunch of music that I made, or at least parts thereof, and then re-recording it with 11 microphones. And we can talk about like spatial audio in a bit, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But essentially, you know, for the uninitiated, I mean, every space you're in has reverberation to some extent. And I think we're very good at cluing into what spaces like are, what spaces are like, subconsciously, just by the way that sounds change in terms of how they echo and how they reverberate. If I blindfolded you and led you into a gymnasium or cathedral, you're going to know that's different than like a small hotel room or something like this. That characteristic of how sound changes as it diffuses through a place, I mean, I think for me is one of the hallmarks of my experience when I'm in the Rockies. And if it's going to have reverb on it anyway, and this is an album that's really not, all the press around this is like how complicated and difficult it was, and it absolutely was both, but it's really just like a really intense love letter to a place that has changed my life. And so it just made sense to bring the music outside and let it get wet a little bit and let it gather some moss, let it absorb the characteristics of that space, blast it out through these speakers, and re-record it once it echoes a little bit with many, many blessings from acoustic ecologists. I will say, I didn't want to be guilty of like the hypocrisy of just blaring noise. There is a way to do this that was at least agreed upon by a few acoustic ecologists that wasn't too invasive. But it also came from another idea I had for an installation where I would play back the sounds of forests, healthy ecosystems in places that had been logged.
Mm.
So this idea of sort of outdoor field playback and re-recording had always been a thing. I also am not going to bring out I collage sound. I'm on a computer, so I can't bring out live players and do it. So it had to be speakers kind of thing. So that was sort of the centerpiece of the record, was that process.
Mm-hmm. And then basically there's three sources, right? There's the human voice, sine tones from a synth, and then the actual Rocky Mountains themselves in whatever form that took.
Yep.
And that's it. And then the actual result of it, there's no effects on the whole record, no EQ, no compression, especially. And then it's going to be in this 3D this 3D space. What, and there's some very interesting, like when you're working with the performers, which are primarily vocalists,
yeah,
you had some interesting sort of approaches to that, which again, go back to this idea of athleticism, replenishment, exhaustion. Like, tell me about exhaustion, because that's an interesting thing, sort of this idea of like energy cycles and how that works. And when you're in those spaces, like, what does that actually mean to you when you're in that space? Because you also talk about like, there's moments of meditation, there's moments of calm, there's moments of feeling, you know, in danger or feeling some trepidation while you're out there because you're in this country.
Yeah. What I love about the Rockies is that it's sort of this, well, I mean, I'm going to use a lot of food analogies. so let's just start. I mean, I read this article about a certain kind of cuisine. I think it might've been, I'm going to butcher this, so I apologize to anyone who actually knows what they're talking about. But this is a podcast, and the point is that I just talk. But there's an article just comparing like different cooking traditions and sort of like Western cooking is very much about complementary flavors, and then different traditions are very much about opposing flavors and the interaction. So maybe like how like early Russian cinema was cut together, and it was all about the clashing of images rather than the complementary sort of flow of images. And that's what I love about the Rockies, is that I feel all these opposing, I feel everything at once. You know, I feel all these opposing emotions when I'm there. I feel calm, and I feel anxious and afraid and exhausted physically and sort of sharp mentally and thirsty. And then, oh my God, your first sip of water after 10 kilometers or something is just like the best thing you've ever had. And it's just like sort of this weird mix of everything all at once. And yeah, capturing that emotional portrait of that place was sort of a lot of the musical goal around that. And then on top of that, I forget what the original question was anyway. That's sort of how I feel about the weird kind of mix of emotions in that place. And that's fun to try to get at from a musical perspective, where I think so many representations of nature in art and certainly music, which there are vanishingly few, compared to the visual arts. I just wanted to stay away from any sort of culturally agreed upon language of how the natural world is discussed, and just try to get at my own sort of experience there, because there are certainly so many literal interpretations of the Rockies. We have data, we have satellite imagery. I've used some of them for the album art. And I just wanted to make a record of what it was like to be a person in that place.
Mm-hmm. What I found so interesting in my own reaction to the music was this, that I kind of felt there was the, what I'd read about it, which is from you, you know, like the things that you felt about it and what you were trying to do and what you were trying to accomplish or what you wanted to say. And then my experience was all a shock because it did not match what I'd read for me. I felt that ultimately what I sort of felt was it was a flip of that almost. It was as if I could imagine the Rockies themselves as a person who was doing an exploratory piece of music about human culture, because it felt like this is a human experience. This is a human sounding record. It's very much about an individual perspective. And then it's very much to me about technology. It sounds technological. It doesn't, again, like you're saying, you're not using these sort of cultural agreed upon, either making something that sounds very bucolic and romantic as in like the expressionist style of music. Yeah. You're saying, here's the mountains and here's the morning dew and the glistening and the sunrise and all this. You're not doing any of that. And in a weird way, it becomes a very personal portrait of how you feel that doesn't necessarily, like I one of the things I was wondering is like, would anyone not knowing what the impulse of the record was for you understand what it is? Because it's like, for instance, one of my favorite sounds on the record I mentioned to you before is this pop, this impulse sound that you've gathered as an impulse response and then shot back into the environment.
Yeah.
And it has this incredible, it's just such a juicy, delicious sound, first of all. And then it's so interesting to know that there was no EQ or compression applied to that, because it's just so sculpted sounding. Mm. But you, as you were telling me before, it's sort of like that's what the environment was. It's sort of creating that sound. And then things like there's the breath of the singers being used, and there's a very collagey kind of like cut up kind of feel to it, and everything's being rearranged almost as if a non-human subject were trying to invent what they thought human language sounded like, or ooh, some kind of a response to something that's like, well, that's not the thing. I mean, from a human perspective, that's not what we're like, but it's an interesting perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it definitely doesn't do that. It's definitely not an album I think people put on me like, oh, let's listen to the quiet nature sounds of a gentle forest rain or the bird calls of this and that.
No, I hope. Yeah, I would. I've sort of been asked before, like, what do you want people to get from this?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, when artists are like weird about that question, you're like, come on, just answer the question. And then you're asked it yourself. And you're like, oh, gee, I don't know. I think for me, I would love if people like listen to this and they're like, wow, I enjoyed that, but I'm not out here trying to listen to it again right away. Like, I'm going to sort of wipe the sweat from my brow and just be like, damn, that was intense in a way that I enjoyed. But like, this is not an everyday record for me. That would be, which is, you're right, it's not this sort of pastoral, gentle, nurturing representation of nature, because it isn't that for mm-hmm. me, or at least mm-hmm. the Rockies aren't that for me. I mean, they're actually really dangerous. You know, there's sort of this inverse, this sort of U-shaped curve that happens in the Rockies. I find that people who don't know what they're doing are so scared of bears, and they're so scared and they carry bear spray everywhere, and they're like, oh my god. And then like you get more comfortable and you get a little bit more cavalier, and you're like, you know what, like I'm not a noob, like I'm fine out here. And then when you really know your shit, you carry bear spray to the bathroom. Like you it's funny how there's sort of this this curve of like learning everything that can kill you makes you scared again once you are more knowledgeable. It's like people who like backcountry skiing, like the more you know, the more you actually don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
I think the really heavy use of technology is this counterintuitive thing where it actually like allowed me to be way more hands-off technologically, or at least way more unfiltered in my relationship with the place. Kind of like IMAX movie or something, where hopefully the experience of watching an IMAX movie is like majestic, and well, I'm not going for majesty here, but like you watch it and the technology,
it's not getting in the way.
It's invisible, but yeah. Nothing is more technological than an IMAX movie, from camera to like the 12 full range speakers that you have in an IMAX film, but they disappear. When you work in 714 surround sound, it sounds very technical, and it is, but in some ways it's actually just an elbow grease thing that melts away. You know, we're not, it's pretty dumb. Like you just use one microphone per speaker that you think you're going to have around you in a home theater system, and that's it. Mm-hmm. There's no weird decoding or ambisonic garbage like that. Like, and all disrespect to ambisonic microphones, I'm putting my foot down there.
Love it.
I'm stepping on toes, but it really is just like, do the hard thing a lot, go out there, sweat. That's the tough part.
Right.
And
use pre-market software that hasn't been fully tested yet.
That part was a little crazy. I did do that. That is a thing that I did. There's a lot of experimental tech on this record. It looks really romantic. The photos of me out there like setting up mics with surrounded by all this like Engelmann spruce. The real battle of this thing was the 4 years after of like pulling my hair out in front of a computer that was not getting any younger.
Yeah.
And you can't switch computers halfway through on this thing.
Right. That's the other thing I find so fascinating, is that there's so much time spent in front of a system, like a technological system, when this record is about something like is your response to that of the Rockies. That's what I find so interesting too.
The amount of just like moving one thing and then waiting half an hour, when you're running like 154 channels of convolution, 300 plus tracks, 12 channels each.
Oh my God.
On like a 2014 Mac.
Oh no. So it's thinking laptop, hard. Laptop,
it just like, and then I use this particle rendering thing to like make clouds of like thousands of sounds, which again is still not really an effect. It's just placing sounds free of any sort of like cooking. But it's thinking.
Yeah.
It's for sure thinking.
So a question I have, because it's sort of like, you know, what's so interesting is different approaches to these things. Like you're talking about this experience that you had going to UBC where you're like, okay, this is not what I'm interested in. This mm-hmm. is, I could learn this. I could get good at this, but yeah. Do I even want to? My interest in music is primarily centered around harmony. I find that to be the thing that I'm most interested in. So the harmonic content of the record, I'm sort of curious as to how that was developed. Like, what was your process for making the things that are tonally based, the vocals and the sine tones and all that?
Ooh. So harmony in, are we talking like changes when we talk harmony? Like what?
Could be anything. Could be implied. Could be keys. Could be no keys. Could be whatever, yeah. Whatever. It could be anything really that has to do with harmony.
Well, I'm curious. Sorry, not to answer your question with another question. Is your impression of the record that it's harmonically complex or like super diatonic, or what is your takeaway?
I don't know if I really, I mean, I don't know if I can really answer that at this point.
Fair.
Fair. Either way, I would say maybe yes to all of that. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe not. I mean, because you don't really talk about that in your explorations, like the written portion of what you're doing with this record. And so for me, I'm sort of curious about how that fits into the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
When you sit down and you go, okay, what am I going to write for the synthesizer that's playing these sine tones? And then what am I going to either write for or tell the vocalist to do?
It's very interesting to me. I only ask that because I, basically if I had my way harmonically, everything would just be a major seven chord with that like really crunchy thing with the leading tone. Like that sort of like, okay. You almost made it and you tripped at the finish line thing. It's just for whatever reason, that's my favorite thing in the whole world. And I, can't seem to find myself writing very adventurous, non-diatonic. I mean, there's some non-diatonic stuff in the thing, but like I find it also gets cultural really quick.
Sure. Yeah.
And can sound very French,
right.
Or like, yeah, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, this was an interesting process of sort of letting go and just being like, I don't have to prove that I can do this, 'cause I actually can't, and make this really harmonically complex. And so it sort of like becomes very timbral for me also. Like the process of writing each tune was very different. Or at least writing any content was very different. I like am super not good at having a consistent routine or process in anything. So I just love novelty. And so some songs would be like, I download some wacky software meant for like Google's thing where it sort of transcribes piano. And then I would then translate that to voice or something, just silly little ways of getting new ideas out. The whole process of making the record was, there was hours, probably days of material that I had amassed over a long time. And then it was sort of funneling that into more sausage casing to make, 14 links of sausage. That is the record. It was not a linear process. Like North, my first record, was every song I wrote in chronological order over the course of writing that record, made it on the record and it was done. Okay. And I wrote them front to back. Like,
oh, wow.
You know, this was very much like I had this huge body of material and I brought on a friend, Connery Ballantyne, to help condense it into a form that made sense.
Okay.
We built the marble over years and then started sculpting the record out of it. And as such, I mean, there's so many different processes and people on it. it's a very horizontal record that results in accidental moments of vertical harmony. And I pick those out.
Ah, okay.
I wrote it on the cutting room floor too. Like it, I would bring in vocalists, specifically Jocelyn Barth, who's my favorite vocalist ever. We would go into the studio and sometimes I'd be like, repeat after me in the talkback mic. There'd be all these like little gimmicks that I would have for generating new material. Sometimes I would actually write it out.
Burpees till you puke.
Yeah. Do burpees till you puke. I'm trying to remember if there was a habanero pepper involved.
Oh, wow.
That was maybe me for a photo shoot. I can't remember. But you stare at the sun until you can't see. No, it was mostly burpees. I was part of the Element Choir briefly. I guess I still technically am. You're never out of the Element Choir. And I love Christine's way of working at the Element Choir. And it's an improvisational choir. And so there's all these sort of like games that you can play that are actually really beautiful. Like everybody start on the same note and slowly, note for note, sing the next note of your favorite Christmas song.
Okay.
And all of a sudden you get this weird, unexpected harmony. So there's a lot of that stuff just to generate a ton of material. Mm. And then I would go through and I would just pick maybe 0.2% of the terabytes of recording that I did for this thing that I felt corresponded to what I was trying to do with the record. And there's some great stuff that I love compositionally that is gone because it didn't relate. And there's some stuff that I maybe even cold about on the record that like made sense for the record. I also can't remember writing any of these songs.
Oh,
I can't remember writing any film that I worked on. I can't remember. It's just like, I know I wrote them, but I'm like, and it's not like a Thin White Duke situation. Like I wasn't coked out like Bowie and don't remember it. I just, such a small part of the whole process is actually writing that I can't even talk about it very effectively because I don't totally remember doing.
So it's an unconscious process in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, you sort of have this like mise en place thing where like you set up how writing is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you pre-produce so hard, and then you also do post-production on the thing so long, mm-hmm. years for this record, that sort of that brief moment of inspiration where you're really in the zone and you're moving things around and you're making cuts and you're dragging in a session from 4 years ago that fits with this idea that you just heard somebody improvise that you recorded yesterday, that part's like kind of quick, relatively. It's still weeks and weeks and weeks, but like compared to and calling Long and McQuaid and making sure they have enough of this one microphone that I want to rent 12 of and like all the logistics around it, it's a small part of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, so you're saying you forget even the film stuff you write, you forget it, but I'm going to have to ask you to recall some of it at least because we're going to talk about another recent project of yours, which is working with the director Niobe Thompson, who I feel like is slowly becoming one of these people who will eventually be called a national treasure in Canada. Film
absolutely.
Called Carbon, the what is it? What's the byline? The unofficial doc or unofficial
the unauthorized biography.
Biography.
If I got that wrong,
I feel less responsible anyways. So this is an interesting project. I like what Niobe says in his little documentary. And this is one of the reasons why everyone is going to want to work with Niobe, because you work with him as a composer and you get a beautiful documentary made about the work that you did together.
It's a gift.
He says, you were just strange enough. And that was why, that's why as a composer, you were perfect for this job. Tell me a little bit about that process of working with Niobe. How did you get onto the project? What was the whole thing about? And what was your process of working with him?
Yeah, I always say, and I apologize if this is a little crass, but like the first feature I did was with Niobe, and it's a little bit like having your first kiss be Beyonce. Like it's it's just downhill from there. I mean, I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of great people, but he's just so good, and he's a true filmmaker. He's so smart. He's such a wonderfully nice person, and he really prioritizes music. He just loves it. Like it's not, that's all there is to it. He's at the recording sessions. He likes to book out an orchestra because he thinks it's fun and he thinks it makes the film better. And he knows how to work with people, and he knows how to work with people long term and keep their eye on his eye on them, and only give them enough responsibility so that it challenges them but doesn't break them. Like, he's working with him is watching a master at work. It's amazing. Being just strange enough that, yeah, working on Carbon was like me trying to dial back the weirdness as hard as I humanly could. And then Niobe being like, oh, there's still a lot of quirk in it. Thank you. And me being like, oh my God, like it's so hard for me to, cause I came from making records to film composition, or rather I learned them both at the same time. I sort of started doing film composition at the same time as making records. And there's a lot of crossover in the skill sets and the mentality of like trying to find the music within a place or scene. For me, that's the Rockies on a record. For me, it's the place or scene I'm given as a film composer. It's sort of an analogous skill set. And so that sort of locally sourced approach where I'm trying to find sort of the soundscape of a film is, I think, a really fun way of working, but it's not necessarily traditional, and it's not necessarily what one would expect from a film sort of meant for all ages like Carbon, a film like Carbon that has an orchestra. So trying to trying to make those two play together was a real challenge. And a lot of it in the early days was being really scared that I wasn't doing the right thing, where everything I would send Niobe, he'd be like, this is too out. Like, this is, you know, this needs to be right for everybody and not just you or I. He really understands what the film needs to do beyond his own taste. And that's like a huge credit to him. He'll be like, I might objectively like this weird palette you've made, but it's not right for the film and what we want the film to accomplish. So it was really challenging for me.
What's your sense of what that film is? Like, first of all, tell us, I suppose, in plain terms, what Carbon is about.
Yeah.
And then what do you think that Niobe's vision is for that? Like, what is he trying to accomplish where maybe what you're doing on the outside is not effective for that?
Carbon, I mean, Niobe is extremely concerned about the sixth mass extinction on the planet, which is a weird perspective to take. I'm just kidding. We all should be as concerned as Niobe is about life on Earth ending. But he's also smart too, and he realizes that Carbon had to be a fresh way of looking at that subject, because so often any documentary that deals with the subject of where we are in geological time is, the only people who are going to watch it are people who are already on board, and that doesn't do anything. And so Niobe has a lot of like very interesting thoughts about how to bring a fresh perspective to that. And he wanted to do a documentary about Carbon, the element, that is sort of a holistic look at this miraculous element that we have that is the bringer of life and one of the horsemen of the apocalypse as well. You know, it's what makes us, and it's the thing that we are unleashing that might be our own demise. He also wanted Carbon to be its own character, which was a very, very interesting choice, and one that I think was really effective. So Carbon is about, Carbon the movie is about the element, kind of from its inception, how carbon is made, how it is the building blocks of life, what it might do for us positively, what it is doing negatively. And so the music kind of had to represent carbon as an element, which for me, I was like, no problem figuring out, you know, I was buying this weird Japanese charcoal that's very resonant and trying to build instruments out of it and all this stuff. And I was like, I'm finding the sound of carbon. Like, I'm digging deep. What was hard was like, this is supposed to be for everybody as a move. You know, this is supposed to communicate this subject, not to just people who are going to go to A24 films. and so I had to like put down my craft kombucha and like custom fixie bike uniform, or, you know, like I had to like really take off the hipster hat and think about making a film that introduced sort of that, in the same way that Carbon introduces a difficult subject in a non-threatening package. I wanted to try to figure out how to do that musically and introduce sort of interesting and what I think are relevant soundscapes in a sort of filmic sausage casing yet again.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is it really pushed against your weaknesses in certain cases.
100%. Well, I would call people like Spencer Cregan, and I would just be like, man, how, you know, I'm used to dealing with small ensembles at best, you know. But on a film like Carbon, where we had, like, I had 100 people I had to manage or more, both orchestrally, but then also like a handful of people who were helping orchestrate. And, you know, it's just like truly head of department shit. Like, that it was, I was a composer, certainly. Again, don't remember it, but I'm told that I wrote all the music. But it was truly like a head of department role. I think that was the most challenging thing about it. There was an artistic challenge of making music that suited the film, and that music was a little bit more traditional than I am comfortable doing, or at least up until that time. And, you know, I think Carbon helped me grow into that a lot better. And but also just technically, like, to make a film in a sort of more trad orchestral way at that level is a project management exercise that you don't learn in music school. And you learn by frantically calling everyone you know at the SCGC, I think yourself included, and trying to figure out just like how this thing gets made.
It is a trial by fire, no doubt. I certainly remember, and I think I still think this happens to me every time, downbeat, measure one, the first thing that gets recorded. And if music comes out, I'm like, oh my God, it's actually going to work. Like, yeah. I still doubt that. I know the notes are all right and it's supposed to match up. But until the music comes out of those players, there's a part of me that still goes, nah, this, I don't know how to do this. There's no way.
No, I don't remember how to do it. The next time I work with anyone, especially Niobe, I'm going to be like having to go through my old emails from Carbon and be like, how did I even do this? It also, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people listening to this will know this, but it was new to me. Like, so many people touch your music before downbeat happens that it's such a team sport. It's a little bit unfair that you're in some ways, like, I mean, not legally, but maybe like kind of cosmically unfair that it's like music by Jonathan Kotchuk. And it's like kind of like if Jonathan Kotchuk was the name of the sports team, that would be accurate. But, you know, there's like five orchestrators. There was like the contractor and the conductor and like a few assistants. And, you know, when you work with an orchestra of that size, especially during COVID, which we did, you have to trust so many people. You have to, by design, not be present for a lot of the process. That downbeat sounding like music is more of a mystery than when you're like working with a quartet and you've touched every bit of orchestration and it's just been you and a computer and a printer for a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a huge mystery. Like, I don't even know how these people orchestrated it. They each have their own process. I'm not walking anyone through anything anymore. Everyone's a pro. So it is sort of like you send it out and magic happens. And then you show up to the studio that's costing your director however many hundreds of dollars a minute, and you hope that you don't lose somebody a huge amount of money and that you never work again. You know, like, it's
those are the stakes. Yeah. But I guess that's what it is. You mentioned in some other interview I read that you have an interest in how F1 teams operate.
Oh yeah.
And I guess it's kind of the same thing, because you have behind the man in the machine that's going down the straightaway at 300 kilometers an hour a huge amount of people who make that happen, the technicians, the engineers, the, you know, the pit crew and everybody else, and the managers and all that. And everyone has their very important job to do, or else nothing functions. But ultimately, it's still that guy in that machine going down the straightaway at 300 kilometers an hour, driving that damn thing. And if it doesn't turn out, they look to Lewis Hamilton. They don't look to the pit crew and go, what the hell, guys?
But if you win more consecutive championships than Michael Schumacher, you also perhaps mistakenly get credited for that, like Lewis Hamilton. Yeah, except it's also a little bit like if Lewis Hamilton also had to be Toto Wolff at the same time.
Sure.
And be the head of all the technical people while he's driving the car too.
Yeah.
Which so it is a funny one.
That's one of the things when you really start to think about it too much, which is probably not a good idea. You go, oh my God, like the things we have to do. I mean, it's not only that, you're a total wolf and you're also the PR campaign and you wrote all the copy yourself. You know, you went out and got all the stickers that are on the side of your car and made sure that you got paid for everything. And if something goes wrong with the suspension, you're out there fixing that too, you know?
Yeah. Like, which is, to be fair, how the analogy holds, because that's really what the only reason Lewis Hamilton is Lewis Hamilton is because he was fixing his own carts when he was a kid. And he knows how it all works. And so he can curate and commission. I mean, it's really not his job anymore, but when you have had to do all these parts, you're not going to be good at hiring the right orchestration team unless you've done it before.
Yeah.
And you're going to hire people who are better than you. Of course, that's the whole point. But if you don't know a little bit about the thing, you're not going to be a good curator. Yeah. I think the other thing too, is that there was also funny moments that nobody prepared me for, of course, where like the narrative around working on a project like Carbon, where you go in and you record a full orchestra and it's crazy and it's scary and all this stuff. And you're like, you have all this pressure and responsibility. Like that is true. And that's the narrative. But honest to God, so much of what was scary about Carbon was like the whole time. I don't know. I live in BC, you know, like I'm a little bit chill, and the whole time, like things would be going okay. And there would be moments where we weren't stressed and like things were just enjoyable.
Yeah.
And both Niobe and myself, even on recording day, like it was going well, we were ahead of schedule. And some of the scariest moments were all of us would just be like, so what's wrong? Because this is supposed missing? To be painful and scary.
Yep.
And if it's not, then we're forgetting something. Like that was actually
right.
A weird mind game that we all had to play.
That's, I mean, there is that sort of push-pull kind of thing between those two things. Like, you don't want your life to be an abject misery and the process to be totally terrible. Yeah. And, you know, you're talking about Niobe in a specific way that he's able to get these things out of people and the way that he operates and still achieves a level of excellence. Whereas you go to someone like, I think Malik's this way, and certainly like, you know, Michael Mann, for instance, was an absolute nightmare and a complete tyrant on set. And the justification is, well, look at the results, you know, like how much does it take to get this done? Like if you're not bleeding from the gums at the end of this process, we've left something on the playing field. Like how much of a chunk of flesh do you leave out there? And is that necessary? You know, I often question that. Like, really, I think for myself, I'm always looking at this 80-20 principle. Like, where am I getting the most amount of value? Like, where do I put that effort? You know, we were talking before rolling about like different approaches to doing any kind of work. And in my case, mostly scoring, where you take those chances and you go a little bit off grid and you do things that other people say are crazy and you're just making your life difficult. And you were saying, well, no, those in not cutting those corners and not taking the easy route, you get that magic. You get that little bit of extra something that comes out in the work. Mm-hmm. But then the question becomes, okay, so how far can you push that? Can you ever see that extra 15%? Like, will you really know that it's still there? Or are you just pushing into a territory now where you're just only making things difficult? I think that's a really hard thing to sort of get to.
Yeah. What a question. Hey, I totally have that mechanism where it's like, if I didn't leave it all on the court, then I didn't play my best game kind of thing. And, but I think there's just like any athletic analogy, there's like working out and tearing your muscles a little bit so that they build back stronger in a healthy way. And then there's injuring yourself. And for me, it's when that starts fucking with my personal life. And you know, if I'm like, wow, I'm tired and this is hard, but like, I feel like I'm becoming a better version of the thing I am. And I'm learning a lot. And like, wow, that's obviously positive. And I think you can push that pretty far in a good way, but where it's like, I haven't called my parents in a while and I'm waking up halfway to a panic attack and like, I didn't eat or exercise today. Like, then that's not worth it ever, you know?
Those are really great metrics. I mean, the ones you said before that were the positive ones. I really like that. Like, am I learning something? Am I growing? Are things getting better? You know, sort of looking at, you are pushing and it's going back to this idea of exhaustion, which I think is really interesting. And it's funny because you and I share this sort of, like I grew up in the Rockies to a large degree because my dad was very much into mountain sports, and we would go camping every year. And I spent a lot of time in Thompson Country and a lot of these places, Kananaskis, where you're talking about. So I know that area very well. And the times that I've done longer sort of tours, right, either on a bike or hiking, there is a rhythm you get into where you fall into your bed at six, any like super early, 6 p.m. sometimes if you're really pushing it, and you just don't have any more to give. You're bone tired.
Yeah.
But it's the best feeling. Like, you're not like, it's not an exhaustion where you're like, I think I'm sick or this is bad. It's like, yeah, no, you've gone to the limit and you feel really great about it. And you wake up the next day, 6 a.m., pop wide awake before the sun gets up, and you're like, let's do it again. And I think it's that. It's like that, trying to find that true exhaustion for your projects. Speaking of which, actually, exhaustion, something I've been thinking about a lot, because I've been in a grind since about November, is how to structure replenishment. Do you have a thought about that? Like, you put so much into what you do. You've got an 8-year long process to make an album. You know, you've pushed yourself to a limit in terms of your abilities with this work with Niobe Thompson on Carbon. What do you do to sort of get something back, or to switch that? Switch off and then switch back on again. Where do you go to? What does the well look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, no surprises in terms of just like eating right and exercising and having a social life. You know, all that stuff, of course. And I try, especially now that I live in Nelson, BC, and that I have gone through the pandemic. Like, when I was in my early 20s, I would very comfortably work 13 hours a day, and you'd hear stories of film composers in LA who are like, I didn't have a day off in 5 years, and that's where I am. And I was like, oh, that's cool, and I value that. I'm much less that way now, and I'm better for it. I think any athlete who takes their craft seriously is not playing better on a broken ankle. They're building in time for rest, not because they don't have it in them, but because that's how bodies work.
Mm.
Artistically, though, I think, which is maybe more interesting than just like, yeah, I play beach volleyball on the weekends, is if I were given the option to only compose for film or only do albums, I don't think I would take it.
Mm.
They really help contextualize each other for me. And like, I'm sharper and more contemporary and better at my tools when I make records, because I am sort of in a fast-paced film composition environment sometimes. But I also, when I'm in a film composition environment, because I have such a deep personal craft, I'm not precious at all with revisions or anything like that. And I would be much worse at the other if I gave one of those up. Mm. I think it's really important for me. Like, one is long and deeply personal and not performance based, and one is sort of like quick, and you have to not impersonal, but it's, you're not making the movie for yourself.
Less, if you do it right, I think there's much less ego, if any ego, hopefully, at all.
Yeah, I think it'd be, I mean, I'd have a ton of ego in film composition if that's the only thing I did. Like, if I wrote this beautiful cue and some director was like, it's not right for the film, I'd feel very challenged, or like, well, was it just going to get thrown out? And now I'm like, oh, cool, I'll use it in my own stuff, or it'll come back eventually, or like, or whatever. Like, I feel actualized as a composer who makes no, I cut no corners and make no compromises in my work on records. And I know that. So it's cool if I make compromises and carve out space for other creative devices in film.
Mm. That's great. Paleontologists and and archaeologists dig down into the literal earth to uncover things and to learn more about what came before.
Mm.
And that's sort of my ham-fisted attempt to transition into what you're working on to next.
Yeah. Well, so I should start by saying that, part of my interest in how sound and ecology intersect as a composer has come from my love of paleontology, which I always find, like, I'm almost embarrassed to talk about it half the time, because it's seen as like, to be into paleontology is to be like almost like into a childish thing. And
it's a victim of its own success. You've got Jurassic Park and plush dinosaurs and kids being interested in it.
Yeah, which makes sense. I mean, but then at the same time, I'm like, basically aliens are real and they're in the ground. You know, it's like a miracle of ecology that we even discovered that these things exist and that they're preserved at all. And not just dinosaurs, but just the story of being into the ecology that we have now or nature at all is the story of millions and millions of years of the same thing happening over and over and over again to bring us here. So it's an extension of my interest in the Rockies, is like how they even got there geologically or ecologically. And when I worked on Everyone and I was playing stuff outdoors, I became really cognizant of how polluted they were with noise. I didn't have cell reception. I didn't have anything, and there's still so much helicopter noise and stuff.
Yeah, you're basically going in 10-minute spurts to actually get the material, waiting and waiting and waiting, and then 10 minutes of good sound, and then...
Yep. Yeah, very, very short intervals of quiet. And it led me to working with Quiet Parks International, which sort of is like a dark sky reserve thing. We find areas of natural quiet that already is quiet, and we try to advocate for preserving them like a reserve. And because I worked on, there was just a weird series of events where I'm like now the Canadian rep for this thing because I worked on Everyone. Which, as a sidebar, if people are like, so do you think like this art will change anything? And like, first of all, that's not the point. Second of all, no, because art's a terrible vehicle for information and like concrete expression. Yeah, because kind of the point is that it's a little bit interpretive. But I will say that doing it myself brought me to a place where I like work meaningfully in conservation now. So, sorry, this is all to say this brought me to this project where myself and another person from Quiet Parks were asked to recreate the soundscapes of the prehistoric past for this release of this book by David Haskell that deals with the evolutionary history of animals making sound. And right now, there's this field of visual art called paleo art, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's people trying to accurately reflect the deep past artistically using what science we have and what assumptions we can make, where the fossil record isn't great. And by my calculations, for the first time, we're asked to kind of do that in an ecosystem-wide way. For the first time, I guess, with sound. And it was just so fascinating for me to like dig into what little research there has been done in sort of like animal phonation from different parts of the fossil record and try to piece together a reasonable guess at soundscapes from that time. Where all this is going is like, that's obviously going to be probably the next record for me. Because
wow.
It's just also like a great way to engage with our place in the natural world, is to try to reach back into the deep time and pick out some piece of where we came from, perhaps like very expressionistically through music at a time when visual art is having a big renaissance with that, with sort of the third wave of paleo art that's happening right now.
In pragmatic terms or practical terms, what does that look like? Because the way we know about paleontology in a sense is they find a bunch of bones and then they sort of make their best, you know, scientific guess as to how they all came together and what the animal looked like and how it walked. And you're sort of making all these inferences, and sometimes they go, oh, you know what? Actually, we put this wrong bone over here and this was supposed to be part of this animal. It's not even thing. Or now they're going, you know, dinosaurs were actually feathered. They didn't have scales in some cases or whatever.
Yeah.
What does it look like when you're doing, like, you're talking about the phone, like early phonation of an animal or something, like the way it made sound? Are you looking at fossil record prints and going, okay, the larynx was constructed in this way and we're going to like digitally recreate that? What does that actually look like?
Sorry, I laugh because I'm imagining like my poor film composers who are like, I'm going to toss on this podcast and hear about film composition. And I'm about to tell you about how we found square-shaped hyoid bones in the La Brea tar pits of like a saber-toothed tiger. What the hell is this?
Hey, it's in LA, so there you go.
Yeah, there you go. I legit have to go to LA for some like filmy meetings in about 2 weeks, and I'm going to the La Brea tar pits for that reason.
It's all connected.
But the funny thing is, if you're into this shit and you're like public about it and you're just forthcoming with your weird interests, like that's the only reason anyone has asked me to do Carbon or another movie coming up that is actually like a little bit paleo, is because I'm perhaps a little bit too honest with like what I'm into. And I guess I've worked as a film composer enough that I'm no longer seen as a liability, because I'm, you know, when I was young, that like somebody is doing a film and it's you versus the film composer who's more experienced than you, but they remember that you're really into the subject matter and that basically wins you the gig. So
yeah,
that's my spiel. But it's very hard, like almost impossible, to reach back into time and pull out certain things. Anything related to soft tissue, which is sound making for sure, color, but we have ways, you know, we find certain, you know, we're able to sort of guess at the coloring of certain feathers because of different crystalline structures that we found and stuff like that. And there's little bits and pieces about certain ecosystem sound that we've been able to pick out from individual species. For example, the saber-toothed tiger has sort of, purring cats have a triangular sort of larynx structure, and roaring cats, not all of them roar, but if they can roar, they have a square like one. And we were able to find enough fossil evidence to figure out what shape of the larynx the saber-toothed cat had. All right, they're probably a roaring cat, they're not a purring cat. Or
no surprise there.
No surprise, which is great. But also, I mean, dinosaurs probably made almost no noise, and that's a little sad because we want them to roar and be big. But yeah, or a little thing like, you know, we'll find like a cricket really, really, really well preserved, and we can kind of computer model what the rubbing would sound like on that fossil together. Wow. So there's these like, you just like reach your hand as far as you can into the deep past, and you might pull out the smallest little thing. And then you go, okay, if this cricket was like that and inhabited this part of the spectrum, ecological niches where only one thing can inhabit a role is true sonically as well, so that's taken care of. Is there anything else from that time period in that place that might have been in the same sonic ecosystem? And you sort of take this one little grain of sand, like finding one little like finding just the skull of a thing, and you try to make all these well-founded assumptions to try to build a soundscape. And it's undoubtedly, just like early paleontology, like laughably off. But then another discovery is made and it gets a little bit better. And I don't know, that the amount of sonic assumption that has to happen in there is leaves a lot of wonderful room possibly for music, I guess. And like, yeah, nobody's going to listen to the resulting music and be like, that's has anything to do with sounds of deep time. But I think like a lot of accidental fun offcuts can happen from this process that might lead to music. So
it sounds like incredibly challenging detective work with very few clues, but on the other hand, the kind of detective work would be going, well, if we don't solve this riddle, it's not like we're not able to give a family peace and closure about this person that they knew that was murdered, but rather we can use all these fun experiments to go off on other directions and challenge ourselves with the art that comes out of it.
There's this YouTube channel I follow called Tasting History, and the guy will try to recreate dishes from the past, and he'll look at this one missionary's entry about this type of corn, but then he'll realize that like around that time these missionaries had this bias, so it probably meant this other thing, and he'll do his best to recreate this dish that existed, you know, 1200 years ago in wherever. And like, is it accurate? Who knows? But is it like fun and tasty? probably.
Yeah.
So that's where we're going.
Oh, that sounds absolutely fascinating. That is so interesting. Any last parting words or thoughts?
Not a thought in my head. I can't think of anything.
We've exhausted it then.
Full circle.
Where can people find you online and follow what you're doing?
Yeah. On all the streaming services, Apple Music now has Dolby Atmos. If you want to give the record a listen in Atmos,
oh, nice.
That's possible. Paper Bag Records is the label for the record. Carbon, I think, should be out soon. So yeah, if you Google my name, hopefully one or two things will come up. And check out Quiet Parks International. That's my plug for the nonprofit.
Love it.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a total pleasure. Thanks for being the first guest to be in person in real life.
Oh my God. So fun. So fun.
And congrats on the record release and Carbon coming up. That's really exciting. I'm going to be seeing the premiere in person. I guess not seeing, but hearing in a theater. Very much looking forward to that.
Oh yeah. Oh, I will say that we're going to try to do a few events around the country in different IMAX theaters. Playing back the record in full surround glory. So if that is of interest to you, there may be an event near you.
Amazing. So yeah. We'll follow up. Thanks for making the time. It's been a total pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes and tagging us at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. The Screen Composers Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Editing, graphics, audio, and video post-production by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our managing director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as the SOCAN Foundation for financial support.